Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Every month, we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee, anything from a 20th to a 100th anniversary. This is your faithful host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse Film Discussion Group. And hey, if you've just discovered our program, welcome. If you're a regular listener, we are, of course, excited to have you back. A stressful showdown shootout among the sagebrush is a trope found in many a Western, but perhaps none did it quite as expertly as High Noon, helmed by Fred Zinnemann, which debuted in the UK on May 1st, 1952, prior to a release in the States a few weeks later. This month's Cineversary celebrates the 70th anniversary of this timeless American treasure, and we're joined by a terrific guest. Actually, it's a voice you may remember from Cineversary episode number 37 last summer when we honored the 65th anniversary of The Searchers. Yes, it's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Frankel, author of High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist, and The Making of an American Classic, and we're delighted to have him return to our podcast. Glenn and I will discuss how and why High Noon continues to rank high among all-time great films, why this Western still matters, its cultural impact and legacy, and what we can learn from this picture all these years later. Okay, before we introduce Glenn and head down the High Noon rabbit hole, it's appropriate to provide the proper backstory on this film and why, how, when, and by whom it was made. And for these answers, we're going to turn to Wikipedia. High Noon is a 1952 American Western film produced by Stanley Kramer from a screenplay by Carl Foreman, directed by Fred Zinnemann, and starring Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly. The plot, which occurs in real time, centers on a town marshal whose sense of duty is tested when he must decide to either face a gang of killers alone or leave town with his new wife. The movie was mired in controversy at the time of its release due to its political themes, and there's a lot more to this story that my guest Glenn Frankel will go into greater detail about shortly. High Noon was nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won 4 for Best Actor, Gary Cooper, Best Editing, Best Score, and Best Song. High Noon's score was written by Russian-born composer Dmitry Tiomkin. High Noon was selected by the Library of Congress as one of the first 25 films for preservation in the United States National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant in 1989, the registry's very first year of existence. An iconic film whose story has been partly or completely repeated in later film productions, its ending in particular has inspired numerous later films, including, but not just limited to, Westerns. High Noon's theme song, also known by its opening lyric, "Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling," became a major hit on the country western charts for Tex Ritter, and later a pop hit for Frankie Lane. High Noon earned an estimated $12 million cumulative gross on a $730,000 budget during its theatrical lifespan. The film places number 27 on the American Film Institute's 2007 list of the greatest American movies ever, and in a separate AFI list of the finest westerns of all time, you've got High Noon ranking second. On Rotten Tomatoes, the feature commands an impressive 95% fresh rating, earning an average critical score of 8.8 out of 10. All right, partner, let's set the table for the film feast we're about to enjoy by revisiting the original theatrical trailer for High Noon.
Judges left town, Harvey's quit, and I'm having trouble getting deputies.
People gotta talk themselves into law and order before they do anything about it. Maybe because down deep they don't care. They just don't care.
I think you better go while there's still time. It's better for you and it's better for us.
Amy.
I mean it. If you won't go with me now, I'll be on that train when it leaves here.
I've got to stay. Why must you be so stupid, Will? Have you forgotten what he is? Have you forgotten what he's done to people? Have you forgotten that he's crazy? Don't you remember when he sat in that chair and said, "You'll never hang me, I'll come back. I'll kill you, Will Kane. I swear it, I'll kill you."
A terror-stricken town left him to face four killers, single-handed, at high noon. With every swing of the pendulum, with every second, a man's life ticked away. Never have so few moments held such excitement.
Miller!
What kind of woman are you? How can you leave him like this? Does the sound of the guns frighten you that much?
Nobody likes a tattletale, and nobody wants to have sensitive plot points of a film they've never seen told to them either. So here's a quick heads up that Glenn and I will be moseying into spoiler land in our forthcoming discussion. So if you're among the High Noon uninitiated, here's your opportunity to dismount, watch said movie, come back, and saddle up for a scenic ride that will make a lot more sense. Take the advice of Thomas Mitchell, a.k.a. Mayor Jonas Henderson.
I think you better go while there's still time. It's better for you, and it's better for us.
Got your spurs a-jangling? Let's ride out and meet film scholar Glenn Frankel. I'm pleased to bring back to Cineversary Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Glenn Frankel, whose books include High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and The Making of an American Classic, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, and Shooting Midnight Cowboy. Glenn has written and spoken passionately about his love and admiration for High Noon over the years, so I knew he'd be the ideal guest for this episode. Now, Glenn last joined me, last summer, to celebrate the 65th anniversary of The Searchers. Welcome back, Glenn, and thanks for agreeing to reappear on Cineversary.
Happy to be here, Eric.
So delighted to have you. So let's get into this, Glenn. Tell us more about the High Noon book first that you wrote years ago. Now, what prompted you to write that book? What did you learn in the course of researching and writing it? And why is it essential reading, in your opinion, for any High Noon fan?
Well, High Noon was actually my second movie book. As you mentioned earlier, I had written a book about The Searchers. It came out in 2013. And I was at the University of Texas at the time, and we held a little sort of, you know, Western Film Festival. I appeared to talk about High Noon. And then a film studies scholar, Charles Ramirez Berg, did a session. I appeared to talk about Searchers. And Charles Ramirez Berg gave a different session about High Noon. I'd always enjoyed High Noon. I thought it was a very good Western. Like a lot of people, I didn't think of it as being in the pantheon of great Westerns, but a really interesting film. And Charles not only explained carefully the blacklist content and context of the movie, which I knew vaguely about, but he laid it out. But Charles also made the case that High Noon indeed deserved to be ranked as one of the great movies. I'd never seen it that way. A lot of critics haven't. High Noon has never been in the ultimate pantheon. And yet Charles made the case, and he made it well. The cinematography, the wonderful tight screenplay and the way it moves, the acting. And so I saw High Noon, newly saw High Noon in many ways, and saw its fresh qualities. They were fresh to me. And the combination of that sort of being that kind of movie and at the same time reflecting that very difficult, troubled, you know, era in American political history, one that has many echoes to today, I might add, you know, that was catnip for me. Because as you pointed out, I'm an old Washington Post journalist. You know, I love movies and I know a lot about a handful of movies, and certainly the three I've written about. my books also take a movie as a sort of looking glass into our history. I think movies are a great way to explore the past, and High Noon was absolutely a centerpiece for that. So in the end, it was irresistible, and I'm awfully glad I did it.
So it sounds like you went through sort of an arc where maybe you weren't as enamored of the film initially, but you've come to really appreciate it. So does that sound like a fair assessment?
Yeah, I always thought it was a pretty good movie, but I didn't think it was up there with the great movies that I'd always loved, like Citizen Kane and, you know, and many, many others. And I think it's interesting. I think Fred Zinnemann, the director of High Noon, is somewhat of an underrated figure as well. He's not considered up there with the great auteurs. And yet High Noon is a stylistic success. I mean, it's an extraordinary looking movie. It looks different than any other film in that era, and certainly than any Western. I mean, you know, Westerns, as you know, Eric, were probably the most popular genre of American movie and the most frequently made, but they relied on things like beautiful landscapes and cowboys and Indians and all these kinds of tropes. And High Noon has none of that. It doesn't even have any gun violence till the last 10 minutes of the movie.
This is true.
It is in some ways the anti-Western Western, and yet it's highly successful. Fred Zinnemann had never made a Western before. Carl Foreman had never written a screenplay for a Western before. So they bring an interesting, different kind of sensibility. And when you look at it now, I think it's awfully successful, not just because of the meaning of the movie, but because of the sort of stark naked beauty of this 86 minute classic. So I felt very fortunate to have stumbled into it and was delighted.
So if you don't mind, can you give us a little bit of context? I'm sure you learned a lot while writing the book and researching for it and so forth. But if you don't mind giving us maybe an encapsulated quick summary of what the big deal was about High Noon in the day, especially the political context briefly, and maybe the backlash that it received a little bit. I just want you to paint a little picture for our audience in terms of the political climate and maybe what the filmmakers were going for here, especially Carl Foreman, the screenwriter, who ended up being blacklisted shortly after the release of High Noon.
That's right. That's right. In fact, Carl was called to testify about his former membership in the American Communist Party in the middle of the film shoot. But we'll get to it in September 1951, but we'll get to that in a second. I mean, there's both a political and, if you will, a cultural context of that time. We're talking late 1940s, early 1950s, when Carl first has the idea and is working on the screenplay. It is a time of political unrest in America. You know, this is World War II has ended very successfully. Franklin Roosevelt is dead, and the old New Deal coalition that the, you know, Democrats, liberals who had ruled both houses of Congress and the White House for more than a decade, that all begins to unravel after the war ends and Roosevelt's died. And you get a sort of a backlash that plays itself out in the Republican Party. And Republicans win both houses of Congress. Harry Truman's, Roosevelt's, you know, successor as president survives in 1948, but the Congress is controlled by Republicans. And it is a time of backlash that has many echoes to our own, you know, age of anxiety now. And so part of that is the House Un-American Activities Committee begins to hold hearings into so-called communist activity in the 30s and 40s.
Of course, this is the Red Scare era, right? Where we're much more sensitive as a country to the rise of the Soviet Union and the pervasive nature of communism around the world.
Well, that's right. This is post-war. The Soviet Union had been our great ally in defeating Hitler during World War II. But after the war, this all unravels, and we're in the middle of a very dangerous Cold War era. You know, the Soviet Union eventually gets the atomic bomb and gets that in part because of secrets that are divulged by, you know, spies working for the Soviet Union. So you have the sense that communists are kind of infiltrating our government and our society. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you know, 1950, the Korean War, suddenly we're fighting communism, and we think it's communism in Korea. By 1951, you know, there are 80,000 dead and wounded or wounded American soldiers who have been fighting in Korea. So it's an atomic bomb armed enemy. It's an open conflict. And the fear here is, and the fear which is stoked up by the conservatives and the sort of right-wing backlash against liberalism in America says these people are infiltrating our country, and they're not only, you know, in our government, but they're in various institutions, and they're undermining our culture, and they're a moral threat to us. And they're scary because they look just like we do. They could be, you know, your neighbor. I mean, who knows what a communist looks like,
right?
But they're an evil group of people under the control of this Soviet empire. Some of these fears were not totally wrong. I mean, some of these fears were stoked by reality of the Cold War, but a lot of it was also stoked up by people who wanted to take back our country and who benefited politically. And the House of Un-American Activities Committee started holding hearings first in 1947, but then going on in all kinds of industries, and, you know, investigating teachers and investigating the news media. And of course, they ended up coming to Hollywood, because
right.
when you want to have a big platform that everybody pays attention to, what's better than having, you know, the heads of studios and actors and people, you know, who get headlines.
Mm-hmm.
So all this is going on, and the motion picture industry gets caught in the middle of it. Also, when I say cultural, an era of cultural change, the motion picture industry is undergoing big changes. People come back from the war and they're looking for more sort of socially relevant movies. The studios are beginning to lose money. You know, before the war, something like 90 million people went to the movies every week.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was the number one cultural, you know, artifact, cultural force in America. The movies mm-hmm. had everything going for it. But after the war, television's beginning to come out. The movies are losing their monopoly on the theater chains after a Supreme Court decision. The old, you know, the old genres are beginning to break down a little bit, and some very lively newcomers are starting out. And one of them is a guy named Stanley Kramer, a war veteran who's worked in Hollywood for several years, starts his own little company. Today we would say it's, you know, an independent startup, you know, nimble and small and challenging and technologically advanced. And he gets together with a guy he's met in the army, a Hollywood scriptwriter named Carl Foreman, and they start making small, low-budget movies mm-hmm. using actors no one's quite heard of yet. Marlon Brando makes his first movie for them, for example, a wonderful film called The Men in 1950.
Right.
Kirk Douglas in his first starring role in a boxing movie called Champion, and he gets nominated, you know, for an Academy Award for Best Actor in his very first starring role. Stanley and Carl are a very successful little group, and they're coming on. And meanwhile, the old studio system is feeling vulnerable. So to sum it all up, when the House Un-American Activities Committee claims to start that it's finding communists and, you know, among screenwriters and producers and others working in Hollywood, the studios, who are feeling very vulnerable financially and politically, decide to go along with this witch hunt. The blacklist is something that wasn't created by the House Un-American Activities Committee. It was created by the studios themselves in response
yes.
to the House Un-American Activities mm-hmm. Committee. And basically, they decided in late 1947 that they were going to fire and or refuse to hire anyone who refused to cooperate with this investigation into anti-communism and into these evil forces that work in our country.
Hmm.
And in 1951, the committee comes back to Hollywood for a second set of public hearings. Carl Foreman had been working his way up to fame. Two of the screenplays he'd written for The Men and Champion were nominated for Best Picture in the late 40s. So by 51, and High Noon will get him a third nomination. So by 51, when the committee's back, suddenly Carl is one of the people they're interested in. And they're calling witnesses, and people have to go through a process. If you want to redeem yourself and keep your job, you had to go through almost a public ritual. You'd be called to the witness stand. You would denounce the American Communist Party. Say if you were ever in it and say what a horrible mistake it was. Then you would praise the committee for the wonderful job it was doing investigating this evil force.
Right.
And finally, to prove your bona fides, to prove that your redemption was real, you would have to name the names of other people who you thought were subversives. In other words, people who had been your friends and your comrades, people you cared about. You had to offer those names up. And even though the committee already knew most of those names, I mean, the committee had the file, FBI files. The FBI was running its own investigations under J. Edgar Hoover of this Red Menace.
Yeah.
But you would have to name folks, and that would allow you to get the sort of blessing of the committee and not face the possibility of losing your job.
Right. It's kind of like a dog and pony show going on.
It was a public inquisition, and it had its rituals. So when you describe it as a witch hunt, witch hunts are a ritualistic purging. And that's exactly what Hollywood and many other industries, but especially it was noticeable in Hollywood with its that big visible platform, that this was the process they were going through. Not only was there this personal and political danger for your career and for the politics of the country, but also this was very intimate. I mean, friends turned against other friends, friends named friends,
yes.
Family members fell out over this. And of course, business partners were endangered as well. And this is the situation Carl Foreman finds himself in as he's finishing the screenplay for High Noon. And he's turning this original story of a marshal, a middle-aged, lawman who's about to retire from his job and he's marrying a young woman and they're heading off for a new life. He's turning this simple story of a man who's about to face gunmen coming to town to, you know, take vengeance against him, into a sort of parable about the blacklist. And
right.
the four gunmen coming to town are the members of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And then the little community, fictional community of Hadleyville, as he calls it.
Which sounds a little bit like Hollywood, right?
Yeah, that's no accident, because Carl finds himself, as it gets closer to the time to testify, that his old friends are beginning to back away a little from him, including Stanley Kramer, his business partner, and others who are worried that if Carl, you know, doesn't bite the bullet and name names and cooperate with the committee, they're going to be tainted and their businesses are going to be tainted by what he does. And so all this is building up, and High Noon takes on this sort of quiet political meaning. Carl doesn't tell people about this, incidentally, because he knows if Kramer, for example, finds out that he's writing a political parable, that movie's never going to get made. So he keeps it to himself. But, you know, looking back on it now, and we can talk more about this later, you can see the points in the story that reflect very much the dangers and the crisis of conscience that Carl Foreman is going through in 1951.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking us through that, Glenn. It was necessary because I wanted to paint a picture for our audience, contextually, historically, kind of give you a taste of what was going on in the zeitgeist of the times, and to kind of inform us a little bit better about, you know, what was behind the story and Carl Foreman's kind of narrative here. I want to segue now and talk a bit about why and how High Noon is worth celebrating 7 decades later now. Why does it still matter, Glenn, and how has it stood the test of time? What's your take here?
I think we have to start with the movie itself and leave the politics aside for a minute. High Noon, as we suggested earlier, is kind of the anti-Western. It is a black and white movie. It's only 86 minutes long, and it looks like a modest kind of enterprise. And indeed, it was made on a very low budget. The Kramer Company was about to embark on a whole new contract with Columbia Pictures, in which they would make 25 movies over 5 years, get $1 million budget in each one. And, you know, so this was the last picture they wanted to make on a low budget contract, and they sent Carl off. The things that make this movie so successful as a film is in part the great screenplay he wrote. The 86 minutes is conducted really virtually in real time.
That's
a few
right.
movies had been made that way before, most notably Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, a movie that Carl saw and loved and wanted to emulate. So you have three bad guys who have arrived in town, and they're waiting for their boss, who's been released from prison, and he's coming on the noon train. And this all begins at about 20 minutes to 11, as we see on the screen.
Yes.
So the marshal, who's just gotten married and is just retiring to leave town, understands that this villain is coming back on the noon train, that he's going to meet up with these three gunmen who he's hired. and that they're going to come to kill him and play havoc in the town. And he decides he has to stay. And that during that 80-minute session, which we watch on the clock, every scene has at least one reference to a clock to show us how time is ticking away. He's going around the town trying to get support, trying to raise a posse of men who will help him resist. And this movie then becomes his journey, if you will, into the moral conscience of the town, because to his great surprise, he discovers that he has no allies, that no one is willing to stand with him against these guys when they show up.
Talk about an anti-Western, right? I mean, this goes against the conventions of so many other Westerns we've seen up to this point, where good guys rouse together to vanquish the villains.
That's right. And the other thing going on here is the Marshal. He's a man, as I say, of middle age, and he looks every year of his age, needs help. He's begging, he's pleading for help. And that isn't the Western hero either. The Western hero is a taciturn, you know, man of great ability who can take on any number. When John Wayne and John Ford reintroduced the Western with Stagecoach in 1938, Wayne's character, you know, kills the four bad guys at the end all by himself. Mm-hmm. That's not what's going on in High Noon. And so you have this wonderful, powerful script and this in real time with these clocks that you're watching, and the tension is building up all through the thing. Carl, there's not one extra line of dialogue. You know, one thing about the Western hero is he's always a taciturn figure and he doesn't have much to say and he can't really even explain himself. In this case, to his new bride, for example, who has no idea why he's insisting on staying in the town. So the script is wonderful. The acting is superb. Gary Cooper is someone that we've forgotten quite a bit about over the years. He didn't work with the kind of directors, by and large, that, say, John Wayne worked with. And Wayne was a much more powerful figure in our culture in his era. But Cooper, in his time, was the most successful, biggest celebrity, and best paid actor in Hollywood. And he bases it on a certain kind of naturalism. Cooper, you know, his fame begins with the beginning of talking movies, because he's got a sort of naturalistic, quiet style. He's a devastatingly handsome young man. By the late 40s and early 50s, though, he's looking for meatier parts. The old studio system, which was functioning, which was so wonderful to him, is beginning to unravel a bit. And he's desperate for a good role. And he gets hold of High Noon. And he's crucial to its success, because this journey that he takes and the way he looks. The movie also, it's a terrific looking film. Fred Zinnemann, the director, and Floyd Crosby, the cameraman, both had great, come out of documentary backgrounds. Fred in Europe, he's originally from Vienna. Floyd in Hollywood. Floyd works with Robert Flanagan, the great, you know, documentary maker from the late 20s and early 30s. And they bring a gritty neo-realist look to the movie.
Right.
People are sweating. It's a dusty old town, and you mm-hmm. see the sweat on everyone's faces. There aren't many close-ups in High Noon, but when you get one, it's very powerful. Right from the beginning of the film, when the three bad guys are riding into town and we see each of them close up, so there's a grittiness and a neo-realism look to the movie that is very powerful. There's no beautiful skies. It's all kind of washed out. It feels like the Old West. It feels like a documentary. Mm-hmm. It's very powerful and effective. So you have great cinematography, great direction, great acting, not only from Gary Cooper, but from a number of terrific supporting actors, including the great Thomas Mitchell, who plays the mayor of the town.
So good.
One of them, the Marshal's great friends, great buddies, as we know. And yet when push comes to shove, he betrays his pal.
That's right.
And leaves. And it's one of the key moments in the movie.
Think about the cast. The thespians picked to play these parts are exceptional. What a deep bench. You mentioned Thomas Mitchell, who gives arguably the greatest soliloquy in the movie. Lloyd Bridges, Lon Chaney Jr., Katie Jurado, Harry Morgan, Otto Kruger. The names go on and on. Even the smallest roles are well cast, I believe.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'd add Grace Kelly to the list. So you've got great acting, you've got great directing, you've got a terrific script. And finally, I would mention the music. High Noon is one of those early versions where music becomes key, and not just as a score. The score is very powerful, but the song, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, which is a sort of plaintive folk song ballad, if you will. Dmitri Tiomkin writes the music, which he later confessed he had stolen from a Ukrainian folk song. Tiomkin is a Ukrainian by birth, Ukrainian Jew who comes to Hollywood. He writes this folk song melody. They put words to it that expresses what the marshal can't say himself to friends and people. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. He's actually talking to his new bride in this song. And the song reveals his state of mind and his fears and his motivation. And it's played over and over again, little bits of it during the movie at key moments.
Yes.
And it's very catchy. It's sung by Tex Ritter in a very plaintive, low-key arrangement. And it really helps string the movie together. It really is the connecting tissue, if you will, in many ways to the film. So All these elements, I would say, plus great editing. We see those clocks every now and then, and they continue.
Yes.
Toward the end of the movie, we see this wonderful montage of summing up the faces of the people who the marshal has attempted to enlist, The faces of the bad guys, everyone, you know, in it. As the music builds to a crescendo, the tension in High Noon is extraordinary, and the denouement, the way that this movie ends, the climax, the bloody shootout, is also beautifully done, I would argue. So
totally,
this is a movie that is powerful as a movie. It's also, though, taken on a certain power as an American story, And that's where the culture and the politics enter in. Having this man who knows that there's a very good chance he's not going to survive facing these four younger gunmen who have come to kill him. Gary Cooper was only was 50 years old when he made High Noon, but he looks considerably older. He's filmed without a filter, and we see his vulnerability. And I would argue it's the sense of reluctant courage. Mm-hmm. This isn't some superhero who's going to go out and cut down these guys, you know, with a laser beam. He's trying to get help. He's trying to do anything he can, even when he realizes that no one will stand with him. He still has to do it. It's a sense of reluctant courage, of vulnerability, of something that you take on because you have no choice. That sort of thing speaks to American audiences. We like to think of ourselves, I think, as that kind of people, right?
Sure.
We're very peaceable, you know, until you push us. And then we do what we have to do. Now, whether that's really the core of an American character or not, I'll leave to everyone to decide for themselves. I have some doubts, but it portrays us the way we want to be portrayed.
Right.
And so that too, Eric, I think becomes a sort of key element in the success and enduring success of High Noon, why it's still worth watching today.
Yeah.
Because it really does say something about our country and our culture.
Completely agree. Yeah. I mean, if you were to ask me an answer to this question, among all the great points you brought up, I think High Noon is one of the very finest and most commercially successful, acclaimed, and award-honored Westerns ever made. Now, it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards. And you have to keep in mind, historically speaking, Westerns weren't always honored by the Academy come Oscar time. So it did eventually win for Best Actor, you know, earned by Gary Cooper. Best Song, you talked about Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, which also became a huge musical hit at the time, you mentioned. Best Film Score by Dmitri Tiomkin. And Best Film Editing, which, in my opinion, the editing is the real kind of unsung hero of the movie. I'd like to talk about this a little bit more later. But consider that in motion picture history, again, very few Westerns have ever even been nominated, let alone won Academy Awards. High Noon was also among the top grossing movies of 1952. So this is no small feat as well. When you look at where it's regarded today, for example, it places number 27 in the American Film Institute's 2007 list of the 100 greatest American films of all time. And that makes it, I guess, the second greatest Western ever on that list, a list that includes, I think, 6 total Westerns. And on a separate list of the 10 greatest Westerns ever by the AFI, High Noon came in just behind The Searchers, which we talked about last year. So it's fitting that we're finally getting around to High Noon. Yeah, I mean, high praise, high acclaim, high esteem. We talked about how this is likely the most controversial Western ever made, at least up to the time, because of the political context, which you so well articulated earlier. I think it still matters because of the evident artistry on display. Glenn, we talked about Carl Foreman, cinematographer Floyd Crosby. Of course, you've got director Fred Zinnemann, producer Stanley Kramer, you know, Dmitri Tiomkin. The editors' names are Elmo Williams and Harry Gerstad. They all distinguish themselves here as fine craftsmen whose talents really stand out, producing a work of lasting brilliance despite a measly $750,000 budget for the time. And so I look at it closely, and I break it down this way. The film's simple but effective monochromatic compositions, the clever cutting and montaging, the effective pacing, the recurrent musical theme, the memorable performances, all of these elements, they coalesce to create a highly effective, gripping, and emotionally potent morality tale in the guise of a Western. I say that because, yes, it's firmly a Western, but you could transplant this story to almost any genre. You could put it in outer space, and it arguably could still work. In my most recent viewing of the film, Glenn, I was really struck by several ingenious compositions, especially those involving moving camera shots. So I don't know if anything stood out to you in your most recent watch, but to me, the standouts include, you know, shots framed from one side of a storefront window that reveal parallel planes of action on each side of the glass. There are shots of the Miller gang riding past the storefronts. There's this really effective image of a spinning wagon wheel in the foreground and the passing town in the background. And, of course, that unforgettable crane shot toward the end that pulls away from Kane, and you see he's standing solitary in the empty center of town, revealing his utter isolation and implied powerlessness amidst a vast humanless landscape. These are brilliant shots and really, really clever filmmaking to me. The evergreen thematic elements also help High Noon stand the test of time. You think about the milieu, frontier town. Yeah, it's antiquated. Okay, we've seen it a zillion times in Westerns. But the essential messages at work, you know, themes of betrayal versus loyalty, alienation versus inclusion, bravery versus cowardice, duty and honor versus self-preservation, they continue to really resonate. It still works well today. It's a really simple story if you think about it, but it could still play well emotionally for viewers as well as mentally in terms of the moral conflict that goes on.
A couple of points that I was thinking about as you were talking, Eric, there are no dissolves in this movie. Mm-hmm. It just moves some, and it uses things like the windows and various ways of moving forward and getting to the next scene without it ever. And that's another example of how time is of the essence here. You know, there's no time for a dissolve. There's no time to back off. The intensity is building with every moment.
Right.
And yes, I think the character actors are wonderful. And two of them, the two that stand out for me, and this has to do with the writing as well as the acting, are the two women. You see two very strong women characters here.
Yes.
Both of whom are in love with the marshal. One of whom is his former girlfriend, played by Katie Arado, who, you know, who has a big conflict with him because he basically dumped her a year before the movie begins. And she's a proud saloon owner, the widow of the guy who owned the saloon before, you know, who she had married. And yet, even though she's angry at the marshal, she still not only loves him, but she understands him. She knows he can't leave town, even though he wants to.
That's right.
She understands the core of the man. And that plays itself out in a brief scene between her and Cooper, where she says, "If I were you, I'd get out of town." And he says, "I can't." And she says, "I know." She's the only one who really knows what's going on with him. And then there's the Grace Kelly figure, this young Quaker woman who has just married the marshal and who thinks he's retiring and they're going to go to another town and, you know, he's going to be a storekeeper. And she doesn't have any idea what's going on, but she knows she doesn't like it. She knows the idea that he's going to stay and face these guys ultimately alone.
Right.
Doesn't work for her. She doesn't believe in violence. These two women have two scenes together in the movie, and they're terrific together, but these are well-written scenes also. Strong women, both in conflict with the marshal, both in love with the marshal, mm-hmm. both willing to abandon him if he doesn't come around, and they each have to make their own decisions, and they make different decisions as the movie goes on as to what to do. I mean, this is great writing.
No question about it. Yeah, I mean, the movie proves that strong female characters with greater agency, it makes for a better story. It enhances the dramatic conflict. You so well articulated this. High Noon is blessed with two powerful women characters, as you said, and Helen Ramirez inspires Amy to have her husband's back ultimately. In fact, Amy plays a crucial role in saving her husband by killing one bad guy outright and tussling with Miller, which gives her husband the upper hand in that showdown. Without Amy, he doesn't vanquish this foursome.
No, he's a dead man. It's a brilliant move. It took them a while to figure out how to end this movie. They didn't know what to do. You know, it's one old guy against these four young guys. And for a while, they were talking about how he'd have to die at the end of the movie. In the short story that this is loosely based on, the marshal does die at the end of the short story. And yet they came up with, I think, a wonderful way of dealing with that. by having the wife, Amy, be the savior here. You're absolutely right.
I mean, essentially, instead of the male hero rescuing a damsel in distress, which we've seen time and again in Westerns, as well as many, many other genres before 1952, of course, here we have a female hero rescuing a male in distress, which is so refreshing. And again, I think it speaks to the evergreen nature of this movie and the story.
Yeah.
Kudos to the filmmakers there.
The only other thing I would say here is High Noon, among other things, is a series of little playlets, usually with Cooper and one actor together, whether it's him and Grace Kelly or him and Kathy Arado, the fabulous Lloyd Bridges, who's wonderful in this movie. And the thing that Carl Foreman has done, he's given each of these characters a real motivation. You know, we really begin to understand each of them.
Yeah.
And it feels real. You know, the problem with the sort of standard Western of that era is, you know, the characters don't have any grounding that we can identify with. There's a hero, there's a villain, there's the young wife. If there's a dark-skinned woman in it who's his ex-girlfriend, she usually takes a bullet for him, like in the second act or whatever, you know? It's rather phony. These movies can be, you know, have a lot of value and merit in some ways, and they can be very entertaining. But High Noon has more. High Noon has depth of characters. We understand the betrayal. We understand the motivation of just about everybody in it. And so that's a powerful package that I think gives it a resonance that
above.
That's right. The reason why at age 70, we're happy to talk about this thing and encouraging people who haven't seen it to have a look.
No question. Everybody has their reasons. And even though you may not agree with a particular character, as small as the role as it is, you can perhaps put yourself in that person's shoes and ask, what would I do in that situation? And it may not be an easy answer. It's easy to just say, come on, people, rally together and get behind your marshal. But again, everybody has compelling arguments for why they're kind of standing on the sidelines. Now, ultimately, it looks rather pathetic and despicable in hindsight that, you know, everybody's cowering in corners and behind closed doors, and suddenly they filter out into the middle of the street after all the danger's done. But therein lies the brilliance of High Noon, because you may not agree with the townspeople's rationales, but you can kind of understand they do make compelling arguments. Glenn, I wanted to talk about how High Noon was innovative or different, especially compared to previous Hollywood Westerns. Now, you kind of segued into this point earlier by bringing up some different facets. I'd like to round this out a little bit more and then turn to you, but let's kind of summarize here. There's minimal action until the last several minutes. Now, most Westerns seek to entertain audiences with more physical conflict in the form of gunfights, fistfights, horseback chases, more violence that spread throughout a movie's runtime. Here, only the last act, the last 10 to 15 minutes in which you really get some crunchy action. The climactic gunfight is not exaggeratively extended or stylistically depicted, per se. We aren't shown, for instance, multiple angles or slow motion or protracted exchanges of gunfire. Instead, it's quick, it's dirty, and it's realistic. One villain is shot in the back. Miller tries to take Anne hostage. Kane doesn't demonstrate any daring do or anything particularly heroic, although, you know, he shows some cleverness when he escapes from the burning barn on horseback. You mentioned how the story is told virtually in real time, depicting, I guess it's roughly 105 minutes of diegetic action within an 85-minute movie. So that was a bit rare for the time, and as you said, maybe inspired by Hitchcock and some others before. Most Westerns are morally transparent. You clearly know the good guys from the baddies, typically. In High Noon, tell me if you disagree, Glenn, but there are a lot of gray areas concerning loyalties, duty, rightness, and wrongness. Now, some townspeople prefer Miller's lawless ways. They come out and say it. Others are doubtful of Kane's motives, and others are indecisive. So you have to ask yourself, are the villagers bad or wrong for not having Kane's back? Each has their reasons. They can rationalize their decision not to get involved. But is Kane foolish and reckless for not leaving town, possibly putting other people's lives in danger? By the conclusion, it's easy to deduce that Kane was in the right, that he made the correct choice to stay and fight, but we have to ask ourselves what we would do if we were one of those citizens in that situation.
Well, that's part of the complexity of High Noon, and that really singles it out among Westerns. Westerns are often, not always, but often, Westerns from that era especially, were pretty simplistic. Good guys, bad guys, clear lines, bang. Carl Foreman is much more subtle. In the end, we do get a sense, I think, that the community of Hadleyville, mm-hmm. and this is kind of a political, I think we're Carl's politics begin to show up, that there's a moral, that, you know, there's a moral rot at the core of that community,
right?
The cowardice. And we only see it emerge over time. We only begin to put it together just the way Kane puts it together as he moves from, you know, moment to moment and house to house and ultimately in the middle to the church. It's Sunday morning. I mean, the moral core of the community is praying. And he goes there to seek their support. And what he gets instead, you know, it's first a lot of ambivalence and then ultimately a cowardness and a betrayal right there in the heart of the church and the heart of the, he's already been to the bar, to the, you know, to the saloon where he's been turned down, but then he's turned down, you know, in the place where both the moral center should be. And so that is something you don't see in Westerns, I would say. Westerns are designed to sort of flaunt American values and to simplify. Mm-hmm. Whereas High Noon is anything but simple.
No, it's true.
And that makes it different than most movies, not just Westerns.
Right.
It's a very special thing that stands out in that way.
Yeah, but you think about most Westerns at this time were being filmed in color. They were lavished with bigger budgets. You know, you're getting a little bit more in the coming years, widescreen epics and things of that nature to compete with television and so forth. But this is really a back to basics kind of a Western. Low budget, black and white. First glance, it could look like a Poverty Row odor of this era. But unlike shoestring budget productions by lesser studios, High Noon could boast of top talents in front of and behind the camera. And as you said, the filmmakers aimed for a documentary-like visual aesthetic, almost a neorealism there by choosing the black and white minus the glossy production values. You talked also about how this is the first major instance, perhaps, of a popular ballad theme song in a Western, which was, from my research, much copied thereafter in other films. So that was a way in which it was innovative, too. But then I want to talk about, briefly here, ways that High Noon was influential on cinema or pop culture. Getting back to that theme song, before High Noon, there were few dramatic films that featured songs sung with lyrics. And you said how the theme song prophesizes what's going to happen. So the lyrics give hints as to Kane's struggles to come as the story advances. This is a bit innovative. Some people argue that it cheapens the score by kind of creating a trend that some filmmakers and fans didn't like. But you can't argue against the popularity of that song at the time. And it really stays in your head. I mean, they repeat it over and over and over again. We talked about how High Noon demonstrated the effectiveness of using time as a source of dramatic conflict. This is a bit innovative. There are a lot of frequent medium and close-up shots of clock faces that percolate the suspense, that continually remind the viewer of Kane's seemingly doomed status. So the movie, it really sets the visual template for a deadline-driven story in which temporal matters are crucial to the characters and the plot. You said they don't use a lot of close-ups in High Noon, but when they do, they are very effective. You could perhaps make a through line from High Noon to later Westerns, like especially the spaghetti Westerns of Sergio Leone. For example, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Once Upon a Time in the West. You're getting extreme close-ups by that time. But I could make a case perhaps that there is some influence, some pervasive kind of nature going on between those and later Westerns. And then as far as direct influences, you could possibly lay out the case that Shane, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, The Wild Bunch, Once Upon a Time in the West, particularly its extended opening sequence at the train depot, a film called 40 Guns, there was Rio Bravo as kind of the conservative statement in response to High Noon, and the TV series Gunsmoke, they all kind of follow in the wake of High Noon, and you could perhaps draw some comparisons if you choose to. There was a film, it is a science fiction movie called Outland, and a teen comedy from the 80s called 3 O'Clock High, which are also direct influences of the movie. There was a 2000 TV remake of the same name, much lesser quality, but it does exist. I learned this in the course of the research, Glenn, that High Noon is credited as the first Hollywood Western to feature a Mexican actress in a significant role. In this case, Katie Jurado as Helen Ramirez. Again, very refreshing to see an actual ethnic actress playing an ethnic character, as opposed to a lily white Caucasian playing, you know, a Mexican character. And then, of course, the picture also catapults Grace Kelly's brief but memorable acting career. So this is really the movie that kind of put her on the map. And so, again, I just want to trace some of the influences of the movie.
I think the thing I would add is the direct line between Gary Cooper and Clint Eastwood.
Okay.
Because the characters they play are very similar, you know, charismatic, but taciturn, lanky, tall. And theme-wise, I think the first clear link is actually between Marshall Caine and Dirty Harry.
Interesting.
You know, a man who is out there on his own, who has his own code, mm-hmm. who perceives the moral rot around him, and who in the end rejects the world he comes from. If you remember, Harry throws his badge into the sort of filthy lagoon after he shoots the bad guy dead. And Caine doesn't do that. Caine drops his badge onto the dusty ground and gets in the wagon with his new bride. And the way they ride, the only two pure people in a community that is deeply tainted, Harry also walks away. He walks back again in the next movie, of course. He's still back in, at the SFPD. But Eastwood, in many ways, is the sort of more postmodern version of Gary Cooper.
Of course, possessing much more anti-hero kind of qualities compared to the heroic, stoic qualities of a Caine.
Exactly.
Let's say. So there are differences, but I see your parallels there.
Eastwood would very much agree with that also. I mean, So the Western, you know, as you know, Eric, begins to fade as a genre by the mid-60s for a lot of reasons, you know, both in terms of Hollywood and in terms of, you know, our culture and our belief in things. Nonetheless, the Western themes and Western tropes continue in all kinds of other genres.
Sure.
Things like Dirty Harry, things like Star Wars. I mean,
of course,
you know, and it survives to move on. And I think people complained, the critics complained about High Noon because they didn't think it really was a Western. They thought it was a social drama that just happens to be staged. And they thought it was somehow inauthentic to the values of the real West. And, you know, I disagree. First of all, any movie where Gary Cooper's carrying a gun and in a cowboy hat is a Western by definition, because Gary Cooper embodied what the Western was.
Well, you also have so many of the motifs, cliches, and patterns one would expect from a Western. You've got a showdown climax, takes place on the streets of a deserted town. You have good characters versus evil characters. Yes, there are shades of gray, but again, it's essentially a good versus bad story. You have a love story involving a pretty woman that is often part and parcel with a lot of Westerns. You have one or more scenes in a saloon filled with rough and tough customers.
Well, that's true, but this almost made the critics angrier in some ways that, you know, that Fred and Carl were, you know, hijacking these, you know, images and tropes, but to use them for a much different purpose. And, you know, that This basically was a Playhouse 90 drama.
Yeah, but to those detractors who say that High Noon isn't a true Western or doesn't really live up to the genre expectations, you have Lee Van Cleef, you have Jack Elam, Sheb Woolley, you have Ian McDonald. These are classic Western faces.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're filmed beautifully. I mean, another inspiration was to come up with the idea of starting the movie with them coming to town. Right. That wasn't the original beginning, but It works so well because that's what changes the whole nature of what the story is. And there they are. And we get close-ups of each of these three guys. And as you point out, all three of them became bigger figures in Westerns, you know, from the Magnificent Seven, you know, to the spaghetti Westerns. I mean, Lee Van Cleef, he doesn't even have a line of dialogue. And
he doesn't even need it, though. I mean, all he needs to do is show his mug.
Jack Elam's in this movie, you know.
Briefly, I mean, right.
Yeah, I it's a silly argument to say it's not a Western.
Agreed. Yeah.
But the fact is, it's so American. Its endurance is unsurprising. Its critical success, as well as the big money it made at the time, is, you know, it's a tribute to what you can do artistically and yet still have a very popular mainstream movie.
Absolutely. Yeah, Glenn, I want to explore with you some themes maybe we haven't talked about yet. Messages, morals, or themes of High Noon. I mean, we could agree, right? Betrayal, disloyalty, these are important messages in High Noon. Despite protecting his fellow villagers for many years and making the streets safer for women and children, Caine is abandoned by his community at his greatest time of need. Civic duty, responsibility, another important message here. It's been said that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So instead of banding together and showing solidarity behind Caine, the community deserts him. They shirk their obligations as responsible and engaged citizens. I recall Martin's notable remarks to Caine. He says, "People got to talk themselves into law and order before they can do anything about it. Maybe because deep down they don't care. They just don't care." We've talked a little bit about the dangers of moral corruption. Hadleyville has been carefully nurtured over the years to become an upstanding and safe place to raise families, engage in free enterprise. But the health and integrity of this community, they're only as robust as its moral core, you know, the extent to which its citizens are willing to abide by law, order, decency, and virtue. And once they permit bad influences like Miller's crowd to creep in, the town risks rotting from the inside out. My last theme here, Glenn, is, you know, being forced to make difficult choices. Cain is compelled to choose between courage, duty, and honor, or self-preservation and cowardice. You consider Amy. She must decide whether to abide by her pacifist religious beliefs or stand by and protect her man. The deputy, Harvey Pell, he has to choose between ego and friendship. And Cain's friends, from the judge to Martin to Sam Fuller to Mayor Jonas to Herb, they also have to decide whether to back Cain or not. Each in turn forsakes him.
I think you've summed it up very well. I would only add that this is exactly the dilemma Carl Foreman faced. Mm. At first, when he was subpoenaed to testify, his friends like Stanley Kramer and some of the other folks in the film company he was working with said, oh, we'll figure this out. We'll stand by you. We've had problems before. But as the time came closer and as Stanley began to realize that there was going to be a big financial cost for doing this and that it would cast a shadow over the entire film company. I mean, he had an FBI file too. He was a good liberal. They began to pressure Carl. What's wrong with just giving them a few names? They already have the names. Why are you doing this? You know, and Carl's much more articulate than the marshal. And I knew, and he was able to explain his motivations better. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that similar thing, there's a line I can't cross. Yes, I want to keep my good job. Yes, I want to have the life that I have now. But there's something, I don't want to be a martyr. Carl knew what the rules of the game were. And he knew that if he didn't cooperate, he was basically ruin his own career. And yet he had to do, you know, in the end, that was a bridge too far. He simply couldn't betray friends. And I think there's an important lesson there, of course, and a theme that we see play out in High Noon. It's Helen Ramirez who sort of understands exactly the dilemma he's going through. And she says to her, to Harvey Pell at one point, you know, Cain's going to be dead soon. And this town is already dying. This town won't survive either. She understands that if you don't support Cain, you're basically giving up on your community and you're giving up on a sense of morality. That's at the heart of this whole thing.
No question. So this is a 70th birthday celebration, Glenn. It's customary to give presents on birthdays, except it's the fans who continue to get the gifts. So what is High Noon's greatest gift to viewers?
Boy, that's a really good question. I mean, I find that being able to watch a movie like this and seeing these wonderful performers do what they did with such a good script and, you know, so beautifully filmed is a reminder of the enduring nature of great film. Mm. We're at a point in life, I mean, movies are very, very important in our culture, and yet there's so many, you know, demands on our time and interest and so many other popular forms that we can, engage in. That sometimes I think we lose a little bit of the special power of a movie to speak to us and to artfully capture the dilemmas of modern life. And, High Noon is just an example of what you can do with very little money and, a few cameras and some great people and how you can produce something that endures over time. So I would urge people, again, to take advantage of the 70th anniversary. Wherever you live, somebody's going to show High Noon on a big screen. Mm. And I just saw it a week ago in L.A. And the big screen, this is a movie that on the big screen is very powerful and important. So if you can see it that way, fine. If you've got to watch it on your, watch it at home, pick the biggest TV you can possibly find. And have a look at how beautiful black and white can be when it's in the hands of masters and how powerful storytelling can be when people like this put it together.
Hear, hear.
That's it. Nothing too profound. Just great work by people at the height of their powers.
Totally agree. You know, for me, High Noon's niftiest gift, Glenn, is its tense tonality and its suspenseful pacing. The genius of this picture is its faithful adherence to temporal realism, you know, telling the story in approximately real time and continually reminding us of the approaching deadline by using insert shots of different clocks ticking down the minutes and seconds to 0 hour, aka High Noon. It's not just the clock face close-ups that matter, though. It's also the nervous glancing at said timepieces by Cain and other characters, their expressions instantly conveying an anxious cognizance of the increasing hopelessness and desperation of the situation. You consider how the filmmakers, you know, they cunningly generate apprehension in the audience by simple suggestion of forthcoming violence. Quotes like, you know, there'll be trouble. He was always wild and kind of crazy. He'll probably make trouble. Nobody wants to see you get killed. plenty of people feel he's got a comeuppance coming, and especially, have you forgotten what he is? Have you forgotten what he's done to people? Have you forgotten that he's crazy? Don't you remember when he sat in that chair and said, you'll never hang me. I'll come back. I'll kill you, Will Kane. I swear it, I'll kill you. So the quotes really lend to the foreshadowing. And speaking of foreshadowing, there are sequences that further tighten the knot, like the barber commissioning more coffins and the kids engaging in a tug of war and play acting a street shootout in which one kid says, bang, bang, you're dead, Kane. But to me, the film's pressure-building piece de resistance is the wordless two-minute montage sequence that ticks down the final minutes before noon, in which Kane composes his last will and testament. We revisit the expectant faces of nearly every character previously shown in the movie within the environments we last saw them in. And we are shown the tracks, the train tracks that will bring Miller's train into the depot at any moment, a merciless metal pathway to perdition, if you will. Every shot, Glenn, it's rhythmically timed to span exactly four beats of the film's main theme that thrums hauntingly and increasingly louder. Each successive shot is framed as a tighter close-up, and the music builds to an emotional crescendo, halting suddenly as we hear the sound of the train whistle, at which point we get four rapid-fire cuts of Anne, Kane, Helen, and the Miller gang. I mean, this is classic Hollywood filmmaking at its very best. Pure cinema that uses simple but strong visuals, stirring music, and precision editing to tell a riveting story within the story with no dialogue needed. So, to me, that is the greatest gift of High Noon.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Is there anything else you're currently working on that listeners should check out, Glenn? Anything going on the percolator there? Do you have a book forthcoming or an appearance or an event?
Well, I'm going to be speaking about my Midnight Cowboy book here in the Washington, D.C. area where I live toward the end of June at the American Film Institute in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's going to be like a Saturday afternoon at 5:00. I'd love to see people come out for that. And again, that's a movie that looks terrific on the big screen and is a movie that's been a little bit passed over. Mm-hmm. It's still well known, but I'm actually taking a break from movie books right now and working my way on a book about Brian Epstein, the manager of the Beatles, another key popular culture person, you know, in one of the biggest popular culture phenomenons of the 20th century.
Fascinating subject.
Yeah. And so, you know, I may have bitten off more than I can chew this time, Eric, but I'm enjoying, kind of trying to enjoy the process and trying really to say some things that haven't been said before about Brian and about the rise of the Beatles. So wish me luck, because I'm really going to need it.
You won't need it. Based on the caliber of your previous work, I have every faith in the world that that's going to be a really good work. So good luck with it, and can't wait to see it when it's published.
Well, Eric, thanks for having me on. I mean, you know, I'm passionate about this movie, High Noon, and I do think it's a little underrated by modern audiences who may consider it one of those things. I mean, everybody will watch The Wizard of Oz, I guess, in Casablanca, but there are a couple of other movies out there that are just as powerful, and this is one of them. So
absolutely. And like you were saying, I think it resonates today because, again, we're in uncertain political times in which you could perhaps read into High Noon. Whatever political stripe you are, it can still kind of speak to us today.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Glenn, thanks again for your time, and keep up the great work and keep watching those great movies.
I'll do that. And I know you will too, Eric. Anyway, it's a pleasure.
Ah, what a delight to reunite with Mr. Frankel for another thorough analysis of a Western classic. Glenn, I appreciate you and all that you do. Gushes of gratefulness for the chance to rendezvous with you on Cineversary. It's now time for Standing Ovations. This is where I give a shout-out to a website, podcast, television program, film, book, or other work that I think would be of interest to classic film lovers just like you. For May, I wanted to alert you to a new series of free movies available online once a month, courtesy of the Film Foundation. Now, that's the nonprofit organization created by Martin Scorsese to preserve cinema. They're working hard to restore classic and independent films, documentaries, and silent features from around the world. And now, some of these movies are being made available to the public for no charge via a restoration screening room, a new virtual theater available through any web browser. So on the second Monday of every month, for up to 24 hours, you can visit the restoration screening room website and watch one of these movies recently restored by the Film Foundation, along with special features about the movie and its restoration process. Upcoming restorations you can view for free include Fellini's La Strada on June 13th, Kumari, directed by Jovindan Aravindan, on July 11th. On August 8th, there's a noir double feature of The Chase by Arthur Ripley and Detour, directed by Edgar Ulmer. Sambizanga, helmed by Sarah Maldoror, is slated for September 12th. On October 10th, you can catch The One-Eyed Jacks, directed by Marlon Brando. John Huston's Moulin Rouge is on the docket for November 14th, and Lost, 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 directed by Jonas Mekas, is scheduled for December 12th. For more information and details, visit tinyurl.com/FFScreeningRoom. Like what you hear on Cineversary? We'd love to get your feedback. Whether you want to nominate a movie for a future anniversary episode, provide comments, or just have a question, get a hold of us at cineversegroup@gmail.com. That's cineverse group@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary podcast to your friends and loved ones. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or CastBox, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that, and leave that rating or review. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook, too. And if you'd like to go an extra step and help keep our show ad-free, consider making a donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donatecineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, we encourage you to visit cineversegroup.com. That's the portal for my private film discussion group I launched back in 2005, where you can hear recordings of our group discussions and read in-depth analyses about the different movies we study. Hard to believe, but it was 40 years ago this June that a cute little alien took the world by storm and captured the hearts of film fans young and old. Next month, we commemorate the 40th anniversary of Steven Spielberg's masterwork of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Until then, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies because they're not getting older. They're getting westerner. They're getting better. Thanks as always for giving us a listen.